The headlines, the International Atomic Energy Agency says Iran will switch off 27 online monitoring cameras at its nuclear sites. Hezbollah warns Israel over its illegal gas drilling operation. The movement says it has enough power to stop Israel from plundering Lebanon's wealth. Also coming up, Israel launches an airstrike on targets south of Damascus. Syria says it intercepted most of the missiles.
Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi.
The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency says Iran has informed the IAEA of its plans to disconnect 27 of the agency's cameras from its nuclear sites.
Basically, what we have been informed is that 27 cameras like this. You remember in December we were showing these cameras on a more auspicious time where we were reinstalling cameras. 27 cameras are being removed in Iran, apart from an online and return monitoring system that we have over there.
Rafael Grossi said Iran will remove all extra surveillance cameras installed under the 2015 deal. He said the presence of the cameras were beyond a comprehensive safeguards agreement, but according to Grossi, some 40 cameras which were installed under the safeguards issues will remain in place. This after Iran switched off two of the IAEA's surveillance cameras, saying their activity was beyond its commitments under the safeguards agreement. Head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization has slammed the nuclear watchdog for the anti-Iran stance it has taken, saying that it is fully under Israel's regime's influence. Mohammad Islami was reacting to his country's relations with the International Atomic Energy Agency and the latest anti-Iran resolution adopted by the IAEA Board of Governors. He said Iran inked a deal with the world powers and accepted restrictions on its peaceful nuclear program in order to build trust. He said the latest move at the IAEA is contrary to Iran's goodwill gestures. Islami also expressed regret that the agency's reputation is being thrown into question because of its being exploited, because of this agency being exploited by the Israeli regime. He added that the IAEA and other international bodies have become hostages to the Zionists. Iran's president says Tehran stands firm on its position with regards to an anti-Iran resolution adopted by the IAEA. Ebrahim Raisi said Iran will not back off a single step from its positions. Raisi said Iran's developments in various sectors is not tied to its enemies' repurchase. This after the UN Nuclear Agency approved a resolution which accuses Tehran of inadequate cooperation. On Wednesday, the agency passed a resolution submitted by the U.S. and its three European allies. Iran condemned the move, saying that the countries that pushed for the resolution put their agenda ahead of the agency's credibility. Tehran also held those countries responsible for the consequences.
The U.S. and its Western allies have pushed ahead with the anti-Iran hysteria at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna. The UN Nuclear Watchdog's 35-nation Board of Governors overwhelmingly passed a resolution criticizing Iran for failing to explain uranium traces found at three undeclared sites. The resolution rebuked Iran for what it has described as Tehran's failure to answer questions on alleged uranium traces at undeclared sites. It also accuses Iran of insufficient cooperation with the agency. The resolution excludes a recommendation to refer Iran's case to the UN Security Council, a move that would significantly escalate tensions and likely sink the ongoing talks to revive the 2015 agreement. The resolution against Iran is said to have stemmed from information within two quarterly reports on the country's nuclear activities that were circulated amongst board members last week. Iran insisted it had declared all sites which hosted past nuclear activities. The head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization, Mohammad Islami, said Iran has no hidden or undocumented nuclear activities or undisclosed sites.
One of the main things to understand here is that the IAEA as an institution is meant to be, exactly as you said, a technical one. But now it is being used as a vehicle for political purposes in order to pressure Iran, in order to continue the maximum pressure campaign that the Trump administration wanted with the support of Israel to isolate Iran.
These fake documents seek to maintain maximum pressure on Iran. The Israeli regime has openly called on the nuclear watchdog to censure Iran's nuclear program. In brazen remarks to the Knesset, the regime's prime minister, Naftali Bennett, said Israel expected the IAEA's board of governors to strongly condemn Iran and make sure it will pay a heavy price.
So what we are seeing now is a campaign led by the United States, by Israel, and by European partners who promised that they would uphold the JCPOA and respect Iran and respect the deal and want to push America back into the deal. They are now turning around at the Board of Governors of the IAEA and pursuing this really regrettable, unfortunate, and downright dishonorable policy.
The IAEA's resolution has drawn swift responses from Iran. Tehran has shut down two of the agency's cameras at one of its sites. The IAEA Director General says the Islamic Republic has informed the agency that it will remove 27 cameras, but that has not been verified by Iran. Now the IAEA and the West need to be carefully watchful, as Iran says there may be more to come as an action in response to the IAEA resolution. To Tehran, it is unacceptable to continue cooperation while the other side has not been behaving properly.
In response to the IAEA's unconstructive approach, Iranian officials have now decided to remove two surveillance cameras of the International Atomic Energy Agency from one of its nuclear sites.
And Iran now, we know in the news, is saying that they will not, if the IAEA wants to do these kind of actions, Iran will reconsider its relationship with the IAEA. And I think it is well within its right to do so.
Tehran says the two cameras had been installed voluntarily and beyond the safeguard obligations of the IAEA. The head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, has hit back at the accusations, saying Tehran has given accurate answers to questions posed by the IAEA, but the agency bases its reports on the information provided by the enemies of Iran. Iran had earlier warned against the consequence of the unconstructive move by the U.S. and Europeans to disrupt negotiations to salvage the multilateral deal officially known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. Iran has warned that it would give appropriate response to hostile moves.
Israel is the main provocateur of this current situation. The Zionist regime is dedicated to seeing a war with Iran. They see it almost as a holy duty, and it's not only extremely dangerous and reckless, but it shows the rogue nature of the Zionist state and of its backers in Washington.
The resolution comes as a pause in the Vienna process entered its third month. Tehran blames the U.S. and its allies France, Britain and Germany for failing to act constructively during the talks. Under the JCPOA, Iran accepted certain caps on its nuclear program in exchange for the removal of international sanctions. The U.S., however, unilaterally abandoned the deal in 2018 and reimposed sweeping sanctions despite Tehran's full compliance with its share of obligations.
Members of the anti-Iran terrorist group MKO have attacked a reporter and accompanying news team of Press TV while reporting on an exhibition held in Stockholm on the group's crimes. Bianca Rahimi reports.
This is the moment an exhibition turned into a series of violent assaults committed by the MKO, a cult-like organization that has the blood of 17,000 Iranians on its hands. Press TV's camera crew, reporting on an exhibition showcasing MKO bombings and assassinations, was attacked by angry supporters of the group.
Don't touch my camera. Don't touch my camera.
Go deep.
Don't touch my camera.
You go deep.
After being driven out of post-revolution Iran, the MKO based itself in Camp Ashraf in Iraq, where members were forced to pledge allegiance to its leader Massoud Rajavi and demonstrate that allegiance with cult-like behavior for women that meant divorcing their husbands and marrying him. Many families spent years on the fringes of the camp begging for their children to be released, but to no avail. The camp was later dismantled in the wake of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Until 2012, the MKO was on the U.S. terrorist list. It was also blacklisted by the EU until 2009. Since being removed, the new leader of the cult, Mariam Rajavi, has forged close relationships with Western officials.
What unfolded on the streets of Stockholm today was a shocking reminder that the EU has become a safe haven for the MKO, which attacks journalists like myself with little fear of retribution. The question now is, will there be an investigation? Bianca Rahimi, Stockholm.
The leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement has urged Israel to stop extracting gas from a maritime field in its disputed waters.
The immediate objective should be to prevent the enemy from extracting oil and gas from the Karsh gas field and to stop this activity that will and may have begun. The resistance will not stand by and do nothing in the face of Israel's looting of Lebanon's natural wealth, the looting of Lebanon's treasure, which is the only hope for the salvation of the Lebanese people. It will not stand idly by.
Nasrallah described Israel's operations in the disputed waters as an act of provocation. He also warned a Greek company hired by Israel against proceeding with its activities. Nasrallah said the company is a partner in the Israeli aggression and urged the firm to pull out its ship immediately. The Hezbollah chief said Lebanon has the right to exploit natural resources from the field, stressing that the movement has the capacity to prevent Israel from extracting gas there. At the weekend, an Israeli floating gas production unit arrived in the disputed maritime zone. The move sparked anger of the Lebanese government, which warned Israel against any aggressive actions. Our correspondent in Beirut, Mariam Saleh, tells us more about the Hezbollah's stance on the dispute with Israel. She says the movement has compared the dispute with Israel's 1982 invasion of Lebanon and has called on people and officials to be united.
It seems Hezbollah is eyeing the situation quite closely. And what we have from Hezbollah right now is a quite official statement from its side. Of course, they said they will not take part, they will not interfere in any of the demarcation process. But he also called on the officials to be united, and he also called on the Lebanese people to be united behind this national cause, which is very significant. He compared this new phase that Lebanon is entering right now to the 1982 Israeli invasion, which reached the capital, Beirut. So this is quite significant when it comes to what the nation is looking at right now. We're looking at natural resources that could be looted at any moment, even if the ship does stand in disputed areas, not in areas that are Lebanese, but they have the capability to basically suck out all the natural resources that are across the coastal line of Lebanon. Now, the ship that reached the near the field of Karish is, yes, UK-based, as you mentioned, but it's also owned by a Greek Israeli. So that also gives Hezbollah leverage. Of course, he had clearly warned that ship that they need to leave the area, that as long as this is called disputed by the Lebanese government, then therefore they should not have the right, just as Lebanon does not have the right.
Israel has conducted yet another airstrike on Syria, this time on the south of the capital, Damascus. Syrian government says that it was a missile attack that left a civilian injured. It says that the missile was fired from the occupied Golan Heights. The Syrian air defenses downed most of the missiles. The attack caused material damage, too. Israel frequently attacks Syria but rarely claims responsibility. Damascus says Tel Aviv carries out the attacks to aid terrorist groups fighting the Syrian army. Syria says that the Israeli raids violated sovereignty and territorial integrity and has repeatedly complained to the UN over these attacks. The Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says his forces are holding on in the flashpoint eastern city of Severodonetsk, which is now the focal point of fighting with Russia over the past few weeks. Zelensky said Ukrainian forces are also holding on in several more cities in eastern Donbass, liberating their land. Donbass has been the scene of intense fighting taking place in different cities, with Severodonetsk witnessing the fiercest battles. Russia now controls most of the city. The governor of Severodonetsk says that the latest Russian attacks have burned down a major sports complex there. Severodonetsk is located in Luhansk province, which Russia says is almost under full control. Luhansk and Donetsk are two major provinces in Donbass. The war in Ukraine is now in its fourth month. Asian shares open lower following plunges in U.S. stocks markets as traders gear up for government reports on inflation. Japan's Nikkei fell 1.2%. Shares on Hong Kong and South Korea dropped at least 1.5% too. Markets in the U.S. Were in the red as well. The Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, fell about 2%, and that is while the S&P index dropped to 2.5%. The U.S. government is due to release new data on inflation later on Friday. It is likely to show another jump in consumer prices. Meanwhile, the European Central Bank has said that next month it will deliver its first interest rate rise since 2011 to tackle inflation that has added to investors' worries, too.
And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. As you know, last week We completed explanation of Surah Ar-Rahman. And from this Friday onwards, we embark on explanation of the next Surah, that is Surah Waqi'ah, which is number 56 in the serial order of compilation of the Noble Quran. It has 96 ayahs and was revealed in Mecca. It takes its name from Ayah 1, which mentions Al-Waqi'ah, that is, the imminent hour or the inevitable event to occur at the end of time. It is the day of resurrection followed by the final judgment, which the disbelievers deny. When it occurs, all false notions entertained by the doubters about its happening shall vanish and its reality shall penetrate every soul, since there will be no question any more of its denial. On the day of judgment, there will be sorting out of good and evil. People will be divided into three classes. Those brought near to the divine threshold for having reached the highest degree of faith. Those on the right or ordinary believers who made mistakes but turned in repentance to Allah and thereafter lived a pious life. And those on the left, that is, the disbelievers, who denied God's message and the prophets, lived in sins and died in the state of disbelief. Ample proof is given in this surah of the infinite power of the Almighty Creator and, consequently, His ability to bring about the resurrection. As for the benefits of reciting this surah, and of course, through contemplation on the message of its ayahs, a hadith from the Prophet says that such a person will neither be from among the absent-minded nor will be afflicted with poverty. Other hadith on the authority of the Prophet's infallible successors say, the regular reciter of Surah Waqi'ah will be listed among the loyal companions of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, will have a radiant face on the day of resurrection, will be able to resolve his or her problems during lifetime, and will be respected in society. It is also narrated that reciting this surah on a dead believer results in forgiveness of the deceased, while its recitation on a person on deathbed will make him or her die with ease. Let us start with ayahs 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 of Surah Waqi'ah.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Idha waqa'atil waqi'ah, laysa li waqa'atiha kadhiba, khafidatur rafi'ah. Idha rujjatil ardu rajja. وبست الجبال بسا فكانت هباء منبثا.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. When the imminent hour befalls, there is no denying that it will befall. It will be lowering, exalting. When the earth is shaken violently, and the mountains are shattered into bits and become scattered dust. Resurrection is denied by the disbelievers as something improbable, as well as by some persons of weak faith, because of different motives, even if they believe in the beginning of creation. These ayahs thus focus on the inevitability of the day of resurrection, preceded by shocking events whose manifestations shall be reflected in all elements of the world of nature. This, however, will not benefit the disbelievers and deniers who happen to witness it, since their fate is already sealed. Resurrection makes alterations in both the physical world and the status of mankind by lowering some and elevating some others. In other words, there will be a sorting out of good and evil. When the disbelievers, even if they were mighty and influential in the mortal world, rendered low, while the believers, irrespective of their social status during lifetime, exalted to high ranks and degrees. Ayahs 5 and 6 mean to say that the earthquake shall be so enormous that it shall pulverize mountains into scattered dust particles. These ayahs are a warning to us to refrain from disbelief and sins by living a virtuous life in obedience to divine commandments, so as to be safe from the horrible consequences and torments of that fateful day. From these ayahs, we'll learn that, number one, resurrection and the final judgments will definitely occur, and denying these realities is detrimental to the faithless and the disbelievers. Number two, the day of resurrection will usher in a different physical world where all will gather and judged according to their deeds. With the disbelievers and unrepentant sinners tasting the horrors of hell, and the believers rewarded the bliss of paradise. And number three, resurrection will be preceded by earthquakes whose intensity will shatter mighty mountains into pieces. Now we invite you to listen to ayahs 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, and 14 of the same surah.
وَكُنْتُمْ أَزْوَاجًا ثَلَاثًا فَأَصْحَابُ الْمَيْمَنَةِ مَا أَصْحَابُ الْمَيْمَنَةِ وَأَصْحَابُ الْمَشْأَمَةِ مَا أَصْحَابُ الْمَشْأَمَةِ والسابقون السابقون أولئك المقربون في جنات النعيم ثلة من الأولين وقليل من الآخرين.
You will be divided into three groups on that day. The people of the right hand. And what are the people of the right hand, and the people of the left hand, and what are the people of the left hand? And the foremost ones are the foremost ones. They are the ones brought nearest to Allah, to reside in the gardens of bliss. A multitude from the former generations, that is, from the communities of the prophets of the past, and a few from the latter ones. These ayahs categorize people in three groups. The first are those whose record of deeds is given in their right hand to indicate their success in achieving the reward of paradise. since they were righteous in belief, did good deeds, abstained from sins, and if any mistake had occurred, they repented of their misdeed, sought forgiveness, and returned to divine grace. The second group is made up of those whose record of deeds is given in their left hand to indicate their utmost misery and the punishment of hell for having lived an unrepentant life of sins and disobedience of divine commandments. The third is the best of the three groups and is placed nearest to the divine threshold for being persons of firm and unflinching faith whose whole life was devoted to the cause of God and guidance of mankind, for whom they served as role models, even if it meant offering themselves as sacrifice for promotion of faith and humanitarian values in society. They are thus referred here as sabiqun, or the foremost, and muqarrabun, or the nearest ones to God Almighty, who is far glorious to have any form or place. They will thus have the highest station in paradise. The ranks of the foremost include the prophets, their legatees, their loyal companions, and of course, the infallible imams and their confidants. Many of them will be from between the time of the father of the human race, Adam, and the generation of the last and greatest messenger, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. A few of the foremost will be from the later generations. From these ayahs, we'll learn that, number one, resurrection will make manifest the truly prosperous persons and the really miserable ones, irrespective of the status they had in society while alive. Number two, paradise is for the persons of true belief, including those who had sincerely repented of their misdeeds and earned forgiveness from God, while hell is for the disbelievers, the heretics, the tyrants, the misleaders of people, and the unrepentant sinners. And number three, pride of place in the highest echelons of paradise is for the foremost in belief and deeds. In conclusion of this week's episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, we present you ayahs 15, 16, 17, 18, and 19 of Surah Waqi'ah.
عَلَى سُرُرٍ مَوْضُونَةٍ مُتَّكِئِينَ عَلَيْهَا مُتَقَابِلِينَ يَطُوفُ عَلَيْهِمْ وِلْدَانٌ مُخَلَّدُونَ بأكواب وأباريق وكأس من معين لا يصدعون عنها ولا ينزفون.
On brocaded couches, reclining on them face to face, they will be served by youths of perpetual freshness. With goblets and ewers, and a cup of a pure drink, which neither causes them headache nor a stupefaction. These ayahs depict some of the unimaginable blessings granted by God in the higher echelons of paradise to the foremost of faith and deeds, such as reclining on couches of the finest brocade and conversing with each other without being the least bored, while being served by youthful boys of perpetual freshness with goblets and ewers filled with the most delicious drinks, flavored with camphor and ginger, that neither cause any headache nor dizziness. From these ayahs, we learn the following points. Number one, the people in paradise recline on the most splendid couches and enjoy each other's company in pleasant settings without being the least bored. And number two, the foods and drinks of paradise, unlike those of our world, are pristinely pure without any side effects.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The Ukraine war is moving full steam ahead. Russia has not only targeted weapons provided by the U.S. and its NATO allies, it has hit the capital, Kyiv. In another major escalation, Putin says that Russia will hit fresh targets if U.S. delivers long-range rockets. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether the military might of either side will decide when this war will end, while questioning what a win would look like in the first place.
Tensions between Russia and the West over the Ukraine war are entering a new stage, as Washington and its allies in Europe continue to send military equipment to Kyiv. The U.S.'s new plan to send long-range missiles to Ukraine has sparked a stark warning from Russia.
If they supply Ukraine with long-range missiles, we will draw the appropriate conclusions and use our weapons, of which we have enough, to strike targets we haven't yet hit.
Putin said Moscow is destroying U.S. weapons sent to Ukraine by the dozen. He said Russia is easily coping and targeting the shipments. Putin said the sole aim of the West supplying arms to Ukraine was to prolong the conflict for as long as possible. His warning was echoed by the Russian foreign minister. Sergei Lavrov warned the supply of advanced missile systems to Ukraine raises the risk of a third country getting dragged into the conflict.
The things that the Kyiv regime unapologetically demands from its Western patrons, firstly, overstep all bounds of decency and diplomatic relations, and secondly, are a direct provocation aimed at drawing the West into combat.
On Wednesday, U.S. President Joe Biden agreed to provide Ukraine with HIMARS multiple launch rocket systems as part of a $700 million weapons package.
The capabilities in this package include High Mobility Artillery Rocket Systems, or HIMARS, and guided munitions with a range of up to 70 kilometers, 5 counter-artillery radars, 2 air surveillance radars, 1,000 additional javelins and 50 command launch units, 6,000 anti-armor weapons, 15,000 155-millimeter artillery rounds.
HIMARS is a mobile unit capable of simultaneously launching multiple precision-guided missiles up to 80 kilometers away. Since the start of the conflict in Ukraine, Washington has approved 11 military assistance packages for Ukraine. The biggest was last month and worth $40 billion. European countries have also followed suit. Aside from that, the United States has provided intelligence that helped Ukrainians locate and strike Russian targets. But where does the line between supporting an ally and actively participating in the conflict lie? Many believe that gray zone is getting dangerously blurred. One wrong political move and the fighting in Ukraine could quickly become a war between Russia and NATO.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Don DeBar joins us. He's a journalist and activist from Westchester, New York. Also joining us is Cindy Sheehan, who's an anti-war activist who joins us from Sacramento.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Don DeBar, let me first start with you. We're looking at the most recent development here, and that is how Russia has launched this airstrike into Kyiv for the first time. Now, Russia has said that it has destroyed what it says was Western-supplied tanks and other armored vehicles, and the position that it targeted was actually on the outskirts of Kyiv, and these were supplies that were provided by U.S. and the European countries. Let's first look at that aspect of it, because it's the first time that this has happened, and that's the reason that Russia has given. Russia has stated that it's going to target weapons provided by either the U.S. and or NATO members, but is it also sending a message that it can target Kyiv?
Not only Kyiv, by the way, but Kyiv is, we said it for, the last 100 years. Just to remind people that Russia said that, they could not come forward into Ukraine, that Russia would not allow it, and everyone ignored it, and they had the coup, and they shelled Donbass for 8 years, and they mobilized to go in and finish off Donbass, and the Russians came in and stopped them. Then they've acquired essentially eastern Ukraine. It's certainly behind the lines now. They can choose to at will pretty much keep it. Crimea is off the table as far as any realistic person is concerned, and they have the ability to rather easily, if they'd like to, either level Kyiv, they could do that pushing two or three buttons, or to take it, just to starve it and take it, and also Lviv, by the way, or Lviv, depending on your preference. And I think that you have to take seriously what they've done here after saying what they would do. When you consider Finland and Sweden joining NATO, because Finland will be facing a similar situation, finally. Not only can they strike Kyiv at will, and people are surprised at that, it may be a fiction that everyone else in the United States buys, and some of the European public, that the United States and NATO are not at war with Russia, but rather Russia and Kyiv are duking it out and we're helping an ally. Russian strategic planners and most serious adults on the planet realize, in fact, that's a lot of nonsense. That Russia and the United States are at war right now in Ukraine. And at some point in time, if the United States reaches into Russia deeply enough, Russia is going to reach into the United States. First, maybe you'll see Warsaw or perhaps even Berlin get a taste of that kind of a response. But they are perfectly capable of taking out New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, et cetera, if it gets there. And they have said, look, that's what we'll do if that's where it goes. And yet, U.S. is going there, it seems.
That's a very fine point that that Don DeBar is making there, Cindy Sheehan, in terms of the warnings that Russia has given. I mean, from the year, well, I was about to say 2014 when the war started, really, but even prior to that in terms of NATO's eastward expansion. So you can see how long Russia has waited. And now we're looking at the numerous times that Russia is issuing warnings after warning after warning that it's going to target U.S. and NATO's supplies. And here it has done so in Kyiv. The point here is why isn't the U.S. and NATO members taking that warning seriously, and or is that because they want this war to to continue, to prolong, so to speak?
Well, excuse me. I thank you for inviting me again, but I don't think that the United States and its NATO allies and, you know, other countries want this war to end. Actually, I think that the profiteering is a huge factor in this. You know, if the United States is the biggest arms manufacturer and weapons dealer in the entire world, so how can the U.S. sell its arms and weapons if there aren't any wars? So I think that Putin and Russia have been very, you know, patient. They were actually very patient for at least these 8 years, like you said, and like Don was saying, how the West and Ukraine has tried to provoke, and NATO has tried to provoke Russia into this situation. And it reminds me of the Cuban Missile Crisis back in 1962 when I was only 5 years old. I know it's hard to imagine that I was ever that young, but I remember how it was the major topic and how all the adults around me were so nervous and worried and upset. And here in the United States, it just seems to be like, you know, the people here in the U.S. are blithely or blandly or whatever, watching the U.S. provoke Russia into nuclear annihilation, which has been a real nightmare, you know, ever since I was born, ever since the U.S. dropped 2 atomic bombs on Japan. And so it's very despicable that anybody would want to profit off of this killing, the potential annihilation of life on the planet. And, you know, it just is, it just shows to what lengths that these people will go to for their profit. And it almost seems like this horrible James Bond movie for world domination. You know, it's scary to be an adult in this time seeing these things. Just thinking, is there a future for my children and grandchildren? And it's really not a topic of conversation. The topic is support Ukraine, and if you don't support Ukraine, that means you must be a Trump supporter. It's just really crazy. It's just super crazy here. I think Don would verify that.
Well, let's talk about Americans then, since you're talking about it right now. Don DeBar. I couldn't help but looking at one of the sound bites of an American in California at a particular gas station who was pumping her BMW SUV, saying that we got to stand with Ukraine because even though the gas prices are so high. So the reason why, I mean, that's one side of the story. The other side are the general public. The general public is watching. The last time around, we had, what, $700 million of military aid that the U.S., got approved. And I'm not too sure if you're a fan of Senator Rand Paul, but I'm going to quote him, no matter how sympathetic the cause, my oath of office is to the national security of the U.S. And, of course, saying that here we have, you know, all this money going towards Ukraine when the Americans could use it. They could use it in many ways. So is that an aspect that the U.S. president looks at and says, it's okay, we got to go with Ukraine?
Well, the U.S. president looks at his teleprompter and he says whatever it tells him to say. I think that's widely known around the planet now. First of all, what Cindy said is absolutely true. This is like whatever else it is also a massive exercise in profiteering. Now, the $700 million that you just referenced is the most recent tranche, but it was a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, they approved almost unanimously in the two houses of Congress $40 billion to Ukraine, and that was the second tranche this year. There was 13.6 before that. The $40 billion is intended to cover a five-month period to basically fund the war for 5 months. Now, annualized, $40 billion for 5 months is $100 billion for a year. And at $100 billion a year, you are almost 50% over the annual military budget of Russia. Only Russia's $65 million a year military budget provides for a military to fight a war in the Baltics, if need be, in Ukraine, if need be, in Poland, if need be, in the Sea of Japan, if need be, and in the off the Korean Peninsula. In other words, the expanse of about a sixth of the surface area of the planet. Russia defends itself with $65 billion. At just this crunch point in Ukraine, we're throwing in the equivalent of $100 billion. Does not include the UK, France, Germany, Italy, Poland, and the rest. That's the first part. The second part is if you look at how much money that actually is, okay, the total housing budget of the federal government, the Department of Housing and Urban Development annually is about $45 billion. Now we have millions of people in foreclosure, millions of people in eviction, hundreds of thousands to millions in the streets, and the condition is deteriorating, and yet we are giving enough to double our budget to Ukraine to cover 5 months worth of war with Russia at Russia's borders. It's insane.
It's interesting. Let me get your idea. Since you mentioned about how the money that's given so far by the U.S. Actually is almost the entire defense budget of Russia. So if you put the two together, then they are spending that much. They should have made more advances, they meaning the U.S. and its NATO countries, compared to Russia. We're going to talk about the narrative. But am I correct to look at it that way?
I think so. Okay. I think that, first of all, if you take a look at what they actually get for that. First of all, if you're going to buy armaments, you need to have an army. I mean, the population of Ukraine is less than a third of the population of Russia.
Right.
Half, or at least a third, their actual loyalty is to Russia. They're Russians. Also, the group that is in charge of Ukraine, the Nazis that are there, they're a distinct minority among the population. That's always how Nazis rule, by the way. They're brought to power by the rich, because that's whose interests they serve. And they get a group of people who are very desperate, excited, and make them crazy and intimidate the rest of the population. But you can't field an army with that,
right?
Unless you have the numbers, and they don't.
We have to talk about that. We have to talk about the foreign, I don't know what you want to call them. The Department of Homeland Security called them American white nationalists. My question to Cindy Sheehan, according to a report that was released by the DHS, U.S. fascists are fighting in Ukraine. American white nationalists with documented histories of violence are obtaining combat experience with advanced U.S.-made weapons. Now, the focus of this release was not so much about Ukraine, but the fact that the DHS is worried that these American fascist white nationalists, whatever you want to call them, are going to come back to the States and they're going to be radicalized. That was the gist I got from the article. But the fact that they're there, and the fact that you have, according to the DHS, there are these white nationalists or fascists that include violent extremists that are actually being recruited at embassy in Washington, D.C. and consulates across the U.S. sheds another light. First of all, do you think that that's true? I mean, I'm assuming it is. The DHS came out. But, I mean, that right. really puts things into a different perspective when it comes to this particular segment who's in the war in Ukraine.
It's a news to me, but I am having some echo. I have echo when I talk. Anyway, it's I don't know if that's true, but they're going to fight with the Azov Battalion, the Nazis in Ukraine. Is that what the
It says, Cindy Sheehan, it says that the Department of Homeland Security, which has been gathering intelligence on Americans who have joined the ranks of more than 20,000 foreign volunteers. I'm assuming they are going to be fighting within or with the members of the Azov Battalion, Azov Movement, who are actively recruiting either ethnically motivated or violent extremists or these types of characters, which the U.S., with the participation of the U.S. It's hard to verify all of this. I can't argue against the DHS, you see, because it's not something that's covered so much by media outlets or by online news organizations.
Well, of course, we have to give anything that comes out of the U.S. government, we have to treat it with a grain of salt, and we have to try to verify it from independent sources. But, you know, we do know that many, these people who wanted to go fight in a war, Americans went to Ukraine to sign up to fight against Russia. And we've seen from these same Americans who escaped from the Ukraine that they were put in these situations with guns that had very few bullets. They were essentially being used as human shields, and they had their passports taken away from them when they got there. So they had to sneak across the border into Poland, you know, using organizations like the American Red Cross to help them get over the border. So I wouldn't be surprised at all if it is true. But it's certainly not like the communists and socialists who joined to go fight against fascism in Spain in the 1930s. You know, it certainly is a different cause. But we see, it's hard because we see here in the United States, we see people of all political stripes supporting the government in Kiev that has been sympathetic to Nazi elements. So we have widespread support for that here in the United States.
Don DeBar, I got to get your opinion on this also. First of all, the whole Azov movement, if you want to call it that, the Azov Battalion, and also the fact that the DHS has come out and saying that you have these white supremacists or white nationalists from the U.S. who are there fighting. What do you think?
Right. Well, yes, there are that. You know, I've spoken with Ava Bartlett and some others on the ground there, and in fact, that's true. Also, some have been captured, and some have come out. And what Cindy said is correct, that you know, they've been lose their passports, and they're trapped in there. Once they get a body in there, they said that we're cannon fodder. These are Americans. The DHS sentiment, or whatever they're expressing in this memorandum, certainly it's a valid point. If you look at Al Qaeda and 9/11, for example, the blowback thing. I'm not so sure that this is, you know, an anti-policy of the government. In other words, I'm not so sure DHS is really concerned about it, and in fact, perhaps they're actually cultivating these things. But I would like to point out, maybe 4 years ago, having conversations, with folks here on Press TV and elsewhere, when shortly after Trump took office. In some schools, for example, somebody drew a swastika on a piece of toilet paper or, you know, on a chalkboard, said, you know, some slur or whatever that indicated that they were ultra-nationalist, right-wing Nazi types. And the whole country went bananas over this stuff. It was an indication that Trump was a Nazi and anyone who uttered his name without vomiting was a Nazi or whatever. And we have Biden here. First, we have Obama and Biden and Clinton installing Nazis in control of Ukraine back in 2014, actively, even on the telephone with Vicky Nuland. And now we have Biden arming and training and, you know, ready to go to World War III with Nazis, on behalf of Nazis, hiring the Nazis in essence, and nobody's saying a word about it. In fact, if you point it out in social media, you get deplatformed for a while. You know, that we are in bed, to the extent that these people are really Nazis and not like crisis actors, then we're in bed with Nazis completely, like, you know, with the covers over our heads. And that should be of concern to people here, whether they come back here or not, because it means the Nazis are already in control of the U.S. government here. We don't have to worry about some knuckleheads coming back with rifle skills and taking over the country. They're already in charge.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Well, we're quickly running out of time over here. I'm not too sure how to go about my last question, but Cindy Sheehan, what I'm looking at over here are the issue of sanctions against Russia.